University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or this station.
Today we are fortunate to have with us Professor Michael Wood, Professor of Comparative Literature at Exeter in England. Professor Wood is not totally unlearned in American ways. He spent 14 years at Columbia University in New York City, spent a summer at Middlebury College in Vermont. His education is British, Cambridge University, in French literature. Became an instructor at Columbia for some 14 years. Has written screenplays for British theater, and has studied American cinema and the mythologies that we create about ourselves by the movies that we make and watch. He is now back at Exeter, has been for some 4 years now. His book on the movies is entitled America in the Movies, published in 1975. He is a contributor, as I said, to the screenplays Seen None, Take One in 1966, and Praise Marks and Passing Ignition in 1968. He's just completed a manuscript on Luis Buñuel, a Spanish filmmaker, which will appear in 1987, published by Oxford University Press. His wife is a native Mexican. One of his children holds three passports, one from Britain, one from the U.S., and one from Mexico. He likes to travel back and forth across the ocean and see friends and family in both the United States and Mexico. He is a student of culture and a delightful human being. If you have an opportunity to visit with him in the talkback session, which will be held in Callan Conference Center at 11 o'clock, or in any other informal setting while he's on the campus most of today, I hope that you will take that opportunity. Professor Wood, we greet you gladly and welcome you to Nebraska Wesleyan University.
Thank you very much, David. It's a great pleasure to be here and to be part of this forum, and you make me very welcome. I do have a pleasure of a special kind in being here, too, because I was born and grew up in a place called Lincoln. That is Lincoln in England. I don't live there now, and I haven't lived there since I was 18. But in fact, it feels like home to me in the way that the scenery of your childhood always feels like home. And so the name of this town sounds to me just about right. This talk is a little more theoretical than the talk I originally had in mind. That is, it's less focused on particular movies and less focused on American culture. I started out to say one or two things about what happens when we look at movies, and more things then seem to need saying. I think they did need saying, and I hope you feel that I've cleared up a little ground and opened up some useful questions. But I am a practical critic at heart, and although theory fascinates me, it does make me nervous. And so, if you hear what sounds like the crackle of thin ice once in a while in this talk, that's probably what it will be. I hope we can get down to particular cases when we get to closer and more personal discussion. The title I thought of for this talk, or there are two titles really, the main title was Making Sense of the Movies. If I were going to give you another title, or a subtitle, I would give you Visually Speaking. Now, visually speaking is a phrase I take from a remark of Alfred Hitchcock. Quite late in his career, Hitchcock worked on a project for a film called The Three Hostages. It was based on a novel of that name by John Buchan. It resembled The 39 Steps, which is also based on a Buchan novel in many ways. And the story of The Three Hostages concerned the kidnapping through hypnotism of the children of three important people. Now, the hypnotism was the problem, Hitchcock felt. And this is what he said. The reason I dropped the project is that I feel you cannot put hypnotism on the screen and expect it to hold water. It is a condition too remote from the audience's own experience. And, visually speaking, there would be no difference between someone who is really hypnotized and someone who is pretending. Visually speaking, there will be no difference between someone who is really hypnotized and someone who is pretending. Now, I don't know how this remark strikes you, but it strikes me as helpful, puzzling, and actually misleading in about equal proportions. It seems to me a small gold mine of implications for the movies, and what I'd like to do to begin this talk is to dig out some of these implications and then see where they lead us. First of all, the remark, visually speaking, there's no difference between someone who's really hypnotized, someone who's pretending. The remark is helpful, I think. It reminds us that the movies are a visual medium. This is obvious, but I think it needs remembering. Is it even obvious? The movies have sound, they have language, they have music. I don't think anybody now hankers in quite the way movie critics used to do for the notion of pure image, the notion of pure silent films, or regrets the actual advent of sound. But the movies are a medium dominated by the image. We can test this. Watch a film on TV with the sound turned off. Now watch the same film with the image turned off. In the first case, what you've got, I think, is a film without sound. In the second case, what you've got, I think, is more or less nothing. You've got some funny noises, bits of dialogue, scraping, scratching, and you hanker for the image. I think we are talking about a medium dominated by the image. But Hitchcock is saying a little more than this, and something more specific than this. He's saying what his long experience as a movie maker taught him. He's saying not only that movies are a visual medium, he's saying that movies are a medium where the visual needs to make a difference. This, I think, sharpens and freshens the obvious thought quite a bit. It explains, for example, how we've come to be so bored at movies that really ought to have been okay. They were well acted, well photographed, the story was all right. Why were we so bored? Well, we were bored because although the visual stuff was there, although the images hung on the screen, the visual stuff didn't make a difference. There was nothing to be seen. There was no difference that scene made. The remark about visual difference, I think, also helps us to look for what does make a difference in movies. Actors, for example, make a difference. I don't know whether you know, but the role of Kurtz in Apocalypse Now was offered to Steve McQueen before it was offered to Marlon Brando. Now, if Steve McQueen had accepted the role, we would have had a very different movie. It would have been rooted in Steve McQueen's face, gestures, the way he walks, the particular kind of creases he has down the side of his mouth. It would have looked quite different, and it would have meant different things from what it means as it stands on the screen with Marlon Brando in that role. Clothes make a difference in movies. There's a nice moment in a recent movie called Pretty in Pink, where Molly Ringwald goes home to change because she's going to go out with a boy she likes, and she comes back to work in the sort of gear she's wearing for the movie, which looks as if it's been collected from various old clothes shops around town. Interesting, but not conventional. And the boy who picks her up meets her at work, and then he says, "You want to go home and change?" And she says, "I already did." Clothes make a difference. The visual makes a difference. That is a real use of the movies as a medium. Camera angles make a difference. Editing makes a difference. Everything that goes with the particular style of a director makes a difference. So we're talking then not about what can be seen. We're talking not just about the visual, but about the visual making a difference. In that sense, the remark is helpful. But it's also very puzzling. Now, it is true that visually speaking, there's no difference between a person who's really hypnotized and a person who's pretending to be hypnotized. But there's no difference visually speaking between anybody pretending to do anything and the same person doing the real thing. That is what pretending is. That is what acting is. Is Hitchcock saying we shouldn't show pain in the movies because there's no difference between real pain and pretend pain on the screen? He can't be saying that. He does seem to be imagining the filming of a real act of hypnotism and then wondering what it would look like on the screen and deciding it would look just the same as if it were fake. This is the point, I think. Hypnotism, like magic, like stage magic, illusion, magicians, tricks, this is a comparison that Hitchcock himself makes. Hypnotism, like magic, is a trick or a marvel in real life, and you can't film it. Interesting, the reasons why. You can't film it, because you can put something on the screen, and you can call it hypnotism, and you can call it magic. But what the audience will see is movie magic. This is Hitchcock's point. The people will think you've done it by editing or by trick photography, that you've substituted screen magic for the magic in real life. I think this means, if I'm following this implication right, this means that movies can make miracles. Movies have got plenty of miracles of their own. They're full of special effects and wonders, but they can't show miracles. They can't reveal miracles or record them. Movies, in some way, have got to make us believe in something existing beyond them. And when they can't do it, they have to quit. Because if you can't show that the hypnotism occurs, as it were, outside the film, but only on the film, then the film has run into a kind of limit. And that is why Hitchcock gave up that project. In other words, it may seem obvious, but again, I think it's important. It's very important for movies to connect to something that is not a movie. Very important for movies to connect out to our experience of the live world. Finally, among these implications, Hitchcock's remark is actually misleading. That is, it is seriously incomplete. I think now we may be beginning, I hope, to get somewhere. Movies rely heavily on visual differences. They exploit visual differences. We could say that visual differences are the medium. But then movies also get a lot of their power from what we can't see, from what's just off the screen, for example, or from what's on the screen but hidden among the appearances. Movies appeal to our expertise as readers of the visible. They turn the world into a set of visual signs, and they expect us to be able to decipher them. And we do. We can. This is one of the ways which movies make us feel at home in the world. They remind us of one of our skills. They allow us to practice a skill that we use for living. And yet they also, movies, repeatedly and characteristically question those skills, this expertise, and show us their limits. The visual tells us a lot, but the visual hides a lot, too. Let me give you some examples. In a Hitchcock movie called Suspicion, Cary Grant may or may not be trying to kill his wife, Joan Fontaine. At one point in the movie, he takes up to her in bed a glass of milk, which may or may not be poisoned. If you've seen this movie, you will certainly remember this glass of milk. It gleams with mystery, with the terrible question that it poses. Is it poisoned or not? It literally gleams because it's got a light bulb in it. that Hitchcock planted to sort of get to draw attention to this glass of milk. He wanted this particular eerie, luminous effect, so if that milk looks strange, it is strange. It may not be poisoned, but it's certainly got a light bulb in it. What the visual sign says to us here, unequivocally, is look, this glass of milk is a question. And it doesn't answer the question. No amount of looking will tell you whether a glass of milk is poisoned or not, no matter how hard or how long you look. It is something the visual cannot give you. Another example. In The Gold Rush, Charlie Chaplin, as the little tramp, makes his fortune in the Yukon by scampering around in the snow and having various adventures in his familiar tramp outfit, you know, too-tight jacket, baggy trousers, hat, cane, big shoes. When he makes his money, he returns to civilization and dresses like an ordinary person, as he dresses like Charlie Chaplin, the actor. Rather smart suit, fur coat. Doesn't look like Chaplin, the Chaplin figure at all. Then a newspaper man appears and asks him to pose in his old clothes for a photograph. Will he pose as the tramp in the clothes in which he made his fortune? So he does. He dresses up in the jacket and the trousers, baggy pads, hat, takes the cane. Now, everything we know about how this... So at this point, on the screen, we see the tramp. But this tramp, the one we're looking at now, is a kind of mirage. So this is not the tramp. This is the guy who used to be the tramp, disguised as the tramp. And if we like to remember, as we may, that Charlie Chaplin himself made a lot of money out of that movie, we could add another layer of the unseen to this image. Charles Chaplin, the actor, dresses up as Chaplin, the character, who is posing as the character that used to be in the costume that made Charles Chaplin so much money. And we don't see this. Or rather, that is what we see, and it's also what we don't see. It's a mixture of what we see and what we don't see. We see it perhaps like the faces hidden in trees in those children's puzzles, where you've got to find the faces. Or we see it like the letters of an anagram that we can't quite unscramble. Another example with Cary Grant again. This could come from all kinds of movies. This particular kind of example. It's to do with it's the image where a perfectly innocent person looks perfectly guilty. You can think of plenty of instances of this. There's one. I don't know whether it's shown you, but there's a truly terrible Australian soap opera that's been running in England called Return to Eden. It seems to go on forever. It's likely to last for centuries. This soap and the. There's a moment in it where two women are in a room with a man. One of them shoots the man, spatters blood all over the room and all over the other woman. The man staggers out of the room and tumbles down the stairs to a waiting crowd of people in this posh country house. The other woman, who hasn't shot him, gets the gun. And then she appears on the landing, holding the gun with blood all over her face and the dress and so on. An English TV critic called Alan Rusbridge has said about this scene that this girl has obviously spent too much time acting in these soaps and not watching them, because if she'd watched them, she'd have known not to pick up that gun. in the Cary Grant example of the same thing, in North by Northwest, Cary Grant needs to talk to somebody at the United Nations building. He finds him. As he finds him, the man is killed by a knife thrown at him. He collapses into Cary Grant's arms, and Cary Grant instinctively tries to pull the knife out. At this moment, the police arrive. He has a body in his arms and a knife in his hand. Anybody would read these signs the way the police do. This is a guilty man caught in the act. That is what the visual says. And anyone in this case would be wrong. And here's the implication that I find interesting, and I think that takes us somewhere. Anyone, in any case, could be wrong. The visual could always be lying to us. It mostly isn't, but it always could be. What the movies do, then, I'm suggesting, is that they privilege a particular way of knowing the world. As they privilege seeing as a way of knowing the world. They show us how much seeing will do for us. And they also frighten us a little by showing us what seeing won't do and what seeing can't do. There's a story told about the philosopher Wittgenstein, who used to teach in Cambridge, who was in the habit of conducting his classes as a kind of continuation of his private meditation, so that students would often feel they were eavesdropping on the contents of his mind. The students went into him one day and he said, "I've been thinking. Why do you suppose people thought the sun went round the earth?" And there was understandably a pause among the students. And then one of them said, "Well, I suppose because it looks as if it does." There was another long pause, and Wittgenstein said, "And how would it look if it didn't?" It's a nice little fable, I think, about what seeing will do for you. Last example of this, there is an elaborate historical version of what I think is the same question in John Ford's movie, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. Liberty Valance is an evil, sneering character with a silver whip played by Lee Marvin, and the man who shot him is James Stewart. James Stewart is now a U.S. senator, and he's returning to the small western town where he started out in law and politics. Asked by the local newspaper man to tell his story, he does. But it turns out that although he has the reputation of being the man who shot Liberty Valance, he didn't do it. He couldn't have done it. He wasn't fast enough, and he couldn't shoot straight enough. The man who shot Liberty Valance was really John Wayne, who was standing in a side street at the time and shot Liberty Valance in order to save James Stewart's life. So that James Stewart faced Liberty Valance, but didn't shoot him. When he gets this rather sad, slightly squalid story, it's very disappointing for connoisseurs of westerns not to have the hero and the bad guy killed in a straight shootout. There's something rather sinister about a man being shot from a side street. And we see it on the screen. The editor of the newspaper closes his book and says, "I can't do anything with this story. What the world needs is a U.S. senator who rid the world of a notorious outlaw. What the world needs is James Stewart as the man who shot Liberty Valance." And then he utters what have become very famous lines. When the legend becomes fact, print the legend. And so we understand that the title of this movie, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, is a kind of pun. There is a man who shot Liberty Valance, and then there is, in quotes, the man who shot Liberty Valance. We're being asked here to live with knowledge we can't use. We've seen the truth, but we also watch history close over the truth, like water closing over a stone. This is, in its way, I find, a more sinister movie, a more sinister ending than the Hitchcock. Because Hitchcock only shows us the power and the plausibility of the legend, the likely appearances. What John Ford is showing us is our need of the legend and the ease with which we make truth into a casualty of our needs. I promised I would see then where these implications left us, and it's time to do that. Let's summarize. Movies rely not only on the visual, but on visual differences. But they are very interested in the fallibility of the visual, in what the visual won't tell us. It may well be, this is an aside, but it may well be that all lively art is interested in its own boundaries. As Joyce's Ulysses, for example, is interested not only in what you can get into words, but what you can't. Joyce's Ulysses is interested, if you like, in all the silent and talkative life that you can't get into a book, as well as in all the life you can get into a book. And then finally, final implication I've already been talking about, you need to film something. That is, the film needs to connect to a filmed world. It won't matter if the world itself is fake, because fakery too is an experience. But it will matter if the filmmakers don't know the difference between the fake thing and the real thing, or if they don't care about the difference. That is, it will matter if they're not interested enough in reality to fake it, or not interested enough in fakery to see how real it can be. You can shoot sets as if they were locations. You can shoot locations as if they were sets. You can build weird planets, and you can make the studio itself part of your story. But you must, I think, be interested either in making things seem real or in how unreal they are. Why must you? Well, because reality itself is always a question, or always should be. Because this way, we learn something about the borders of reality, which are not fixed and may need changing. Because although they're not fixed everywhere, they are fixed in some places, and we need to know where those places are. It is difficult, and it's sometimes impossible, to tell a fake from the real thing, in movies or in life. But that is not the same as saying there is no difference between a fake and the real thing, or that the difference doesn't matter. Stanley Cavell, a philosopher and writer on film, whose work I much admire, worries greatly about this question of reality in the movies. He thinks it is, his phrase, a matter of cinematic fact that the movies present a world which is real and complete without us. He was accused by readers of his fine book called The World View, of being naive about reality, of thinking all films just photograph real things and that reality just gets straight onto the film. This wasn't at all what Stanley Cavell meant. It wasn't what he really could have meant, I think, but it was what he seemed to be saying. I can't do more than allude to his answer here. It appeared in an article called More of the World Viewed, and was later included in a new edition of the original book, but a quick allusion may be useful. Cavell starts out by making what I find rather heavy weather of the question of whether cartoons are movies or not. I want to say, of course they are, what else would they be? He wants to say, of course they're not, because they're not moving pictures of anything that can be found in the real world. That's what movies are. If cartoons are movies, as Cavell's opponents argue, then the movies cannot necessarily have the special engagement with reality that Cavell wants to claim for them. The real, he defines, without philosophical fuss, as live persons and real things in actual spaces. What is special about the movies for Cavell is that they start life in a camera, and the camera must have something in front of it, however posed or faked or framed. The camera can be lied to, let's say, but it cannot itself lie. Cartoons, Cavell thinks, are not an exception to this rule, but another game entirely. I think myself that Cavell could afford to admit that cartoons and movies and still pursue his argument about reality, although he would then have to shift his ground a bit. But in my view, it needs shifting anyway. Once we've allowed that live persons and real things in a film can include actors and props, Orson Welles, say, made up as a man three times his own age, and a clue planted just for the camera to find. And once we've allowed that actual spaces can include highly artificial sets, then the real becomes a different matter. The real is not something sitting in front of the camera and being photographed. The real is something that is created in the camera. Or rather, the real is something jointly created by the camera and by our faith in the camera's fidelity to the real world. This process is technically different from our creation of reality through language and our faith in the capacity of words to name things, but the difference does not, I think, touch the question of reality. Reality is always a mixed creation, partly given to us by what is materially there and partly taken by us, taken by the mind or the culture by believing in it. A material reality that no one perceives or believes in is there, if you like, but it's not real in any active sense. A reality that is purely a matter of belief with no corroboration either from facts or from other people is not a reality. We find and we build reality through a constant testing of faith. We ask for coffee and we get a cup of coffee. And then we taste it and it tastes like coffee. And we do this again, and we keep getting coffee. This doesn't alter the fact that we're committing an act of faith when we ask for coffee. It just means it's a good bet. We look at the 20-year-old Orson Welles in Citizen Kane, and we say, well, he's supposed to be 60. He looks 60. Let's believe he's 60, as long as the movie asks it of us. We do the same sort of thing in ordinary life when we believe, for example, that things are going to work out when we know they're not. They don't work out. But they don't crash as badly as they would if we simply believed they were going to crash. Our believing that they were going to work out doesn't make them work out, but it is part of the reality of the way the things actually turn out. Sometimes, of course, we ask for a cup of coffee, and like Joan Fontaine, we get a glass of milk with a light bulb. Nothing I've said so far or quoted Cavell as saying is specific to the movies. That is, to the movies as distinct from photography or video or TV. Now, I want to be as specific as I can here, but I don't want to invent pigeonholes for the sake of inventing pigeonholes. What I'm talking about is about making sense of the movies, and for me, essentially, the movies are moving images. That takes photography out, but not the others. The movement within the shot, it seems to me, makes all the difference. This first came to me some years ago when I was looking at a film by John Ford called Young Mr. Lincoln, in which Henry Ford plays Lincoln. And I was looking at it on a moviola, an editing machine where you could put the film on and run it through a thing that looks like a TV screen and stop it and rewind it. And I was looking at a scene in which Henry Ford, as Lincoln, goes to Ann Rutledge's grave. He kneels by the grave in the churchyard. There's a tree, there are the graves. There's a river. He kneels by the grave and he's entirely stationary. And I stopped the film there to make some notes about the composition of this shot. I wanted to sort of figure out exactly how it was put together. And I made the notes, but then it all looked wrong and I couldn't figure out what was wrong. I ran it back again, stopped it. It still looked wrong. And it was several minutes before I realized what was wrong with this frozen image. No one was moving. Henry Fonda wasn't making any gestures, or the trees weren't moving, the wind wasn't blowing. What was missing was the river flowing. What the still could not show to me, what the frozen image couldn't show to me, was the flowing of the river. Movies are not photographs that move. No amount of stills will ever add up to a movie. Movies are another use of the camera. And I would go further. I think I would say that whenever you notice the photography in a film, it probably means that something's going wrong. It probably means the movie's trying to turn into a calendar or something. Video and television are different in all kinds of ways. They're different from each other, they're different from the movies, but they're not different in this respect of movement, of being concerned with moving images. So for some of what I want to say, video and movie, I think, can be included. In fact, I'd like briefly to open the focus still wider for a moment, really wide, I mean outside the medium of movies altogether. Part of my brief today is popular culture. The relation of movies to jokes, chat shows, novels, songs, musicals, proverbs, soap operas, dances, many things. There is no one way of talking about this relation. There is indeed no one relation. But there is one thing that many of these forms have in common. They are stories, or they tell stories. And I think we can say something about how we make sense of stories and what we use stories for. The actual making of the sense we'll have to do in practice and on the spot, and maybe later with particular stories. Louis Menand, in an interesting article about special effects in movies, says, I quote, "We might call the invention of film an event in the history of narrative." We might call the invention of film an event in the history of narrative. Now, in this light, even the visual properties I've evoked are not essential. They are just the conditions of the medium. They're the road you take if your road leads you through the movies. Film at one time was a new popular mode of telling stories, a means of distribution. And from this point of view, what matters is not the means, but the stories. And plenty of different means will deliver the same stories. There's a song, for example, by Paul Simon called, many of you must know, called Train in the Distance, which says, among other things, that negotiations and love songs are often mistaken for one and the same. Negotiations and love songs are often mistaken for one and the same. How many other songs, jokes, movie plots, TV shows, and indeed bits of real-life narrative does that phrase not cover? The song itself is a story. The song Train of Distance is a story about a couple who, a man who very much wants to marry a girl, and does, and then things just fall apart. And at the end of the song, the last verse of the song is something like this. What is the point of this story? What information pertains? The thought that life could be better is woven indelibly into our hearts and our brains. Now that's a good story, and it's been told in many, many media. The stories that I picked up in my book on American movies, the one that David mentioned, America and the Movies, these are stories about, they were American stories, stories that the movies habitually told, stories about lonely men like Humphrey Bogart, or dangerous women like Rita Hayworth, about winning and losing, as in movies like The Hustler, which is about pool playing, or The Cincinnati Kid, which is about poker, or The Fastest Gun Alive, which is about being the fastest gun alive until you're dead. about stories about singing and dancing, what happens in American musicals with Gene Kelly or Fred Astaire. Stories about quests for extravagance in epics. What does it mean to say this is a Cecil B. DeMille epic? There was a whole story in that very proposition. Quests for innocence in crime movies or in problem movies. But these stories, which I found in the movies, were not confined to the movies. They were part of American culture, and still are, many of them. The interesting thing about these stories is, what are they about? Why do we need them? Why do we tell them? Or why do we listen to them? Of course, the movies were a main means of distribution of stories in the 40s and 50s, and that was my reason for studying them. The movies were the biggest mirror there was if you were looking for reflections of America. Still, a study of what's reflected in a mirror is not a study of optics. And it's clear to me now than it was when I wrote the book. The book was published in 1975. It's clear to me now that at its broadest, my interest, and perhaps many other people's interest, in both film and literature, is an interest in narrative. That is, it's an interest in stories and how they catch bits of reality and connect themselves to our experience. The stories don't always catch the expected bits of reality or the ones they're supposed to, The connection to experience are not always comfortable, or sometimes they're too comfortable, just a way of patting ourselves on the back. But they're always there. They're always worth looking at. The stories and the connection are all that I look for in literature or in film. I'm interested in details of language and form too. And in a moment, I will return to the peculiar and specific nature of the movies as a medium. But the stories and the connections do suggest a way in which literature and film can be seen to be happily linked. Or rather, they don't need linking anymore, because they're all already linked. They're part of the same common enterprise. What sort of stories do we tell to each other? What sort of stories do we need and like? I'd like to try and draw out a little more fully a theory that is really only hinted at in my book. In fact, it's hinted at so delicately that I could scarcely see it myself without squinting. I had to do a little digging to get this theory out. And it's slightly mystifying to me now why I was so worried about this theory. I guess I was so anxious about not being heavy-handed in this book that I tripped so lightly you couldn't see where I'd been. It did produce the effect, I think, of my offering a theory that I didn't really care about or believe in, or not offering a theory at all. I think was unfortunate and not true. I think there is a theory there, and I think it works. It's a theory of entertainment, and I'd be glad to have your views and comments on it. Criticism and theory, it seems to me, are conversations, or they're nothing at all. They're not a matter of assertion without answer or without echo. The theory then goes roughly like this. Entertainment, the chief business of popular culture, is not an escape from the world of our worries. It is a rearrangement of those worries into a manageable order. The worries are recognized, but made marginal or made trivial. They are made laughable. They're made tiny. They are seemingly resolved, seemingly shelved. They are made to cancel each other out. We can do all kinds of things to our worries in these stories. What we cannot do, I think, is abolish them. If we could abolish them, we wouldn't need entertainment. And another thing we cannot do is ignore them, because if we ignored them, it wouldn't be entertainment. It would be some kind of dazed, dreamless sleep. What sort of worries are they? Well, there are all kinds of worries, any kind of worry in principle, but in practice, I think, they are in popular culture one particular kind of worry, or, if you like, worries that come from one particular place. We've been a little bullied by Freudians, not by Freud himself, I think, but by Freud's legacy, into thinking that consciousness and unconsciousness are the only two modes the mind knows. Either we can remember something, or we can't remember it because we've repressed it, like an on-off switch. Now, I don't think the mind works like this, and ordinary language is much wiser, and it's got a name for what I need to talk about. Popular culture, the home of popular culture, I think, the place where the jokes and the songs and the stories get their energy from, is not some dark den of archetypes and traumas, but that much more accessible zone that we call the back of the mind. The back of the mind is where we keep all the things we put off thinking about, all the doubts we'd rather not have, all the memories that nag at us, the things we should have done and didn't, the riddles we can't solve, the contradictions we can't bear, the insults and griefs we're trying to forget, and much, much more. This stuff is not repressed, and it's not unrecognizable. Indeed, we know it very well. That's how we know we don't want to think about it. That's why we're keeping it at the back of the mind and not at the front. Now, how do these worries get into stories? Well, they get into stories in a characteristically indirect and offhand way. They get in by the back door, so to speak, perhaps being faithful to their origins in the back of the mind. In a movie called For Me and My Girl, for example, Gene Kelly is asleep with a newspaper over his face. The headline facing us, unseen by Gene Kelly, says, "Lusitania sinks." Now, he can't see it. He's asleep. He's not interested in it, but we can see it. There's another. There's a similar image, in a different form, in a famous Charles Adams cartoon that some of you may remember. It's a cartoon from the late 60s, I think. It shows a beach. It's full of people, contemporary people who are contemporary in the 60s, wearing bikinis, carrying transistor radios, having all the kit of that time. And there's one man asleep with his face under a newspaper, and he's wearing a very old-fashioned bathing suit. You know, wears a long thing, you know, he needs his stripes and so on. He's got a newspaper over his face. And there's a headline on his newspaper too, and it says, "Archduke murdered at Sarajevo." This, I'm suggesting, the Gene Kelly picture and the Charles Adams picture, I think they're pictures of the way popular culture works. You could apply the same sort of thing to Dickens and to large chunks of Shakespeare. It's not that the Lusitania doesn't sink in this story. It's that the sinking is not important in the story. The sinking of the Lusitania is there, but it doesn't make any difference. Now, if I'm right about this, then the old and familiar distinction between art and entertainment needs recasting or perhaps melting down. Art, let's say, provisionally, is entertainment where the worries are busy and noisy and attended to. And maybe, I'm not sure about this, maybe art is entertainment where the worries are major worries as well. Entertainment is art where the worries get to play in a corner and are encouraged to speak only in whispers. I'm not suggesting we can find deep meanings even in the flimsiest stories. We can, but it may not always be a good idea. I'm suggesting that everyday worries get exercised and appeased by the stories we tell. And they get exercised and appeased without our really having to pay much attention to them. Think of ethnic jokes and horror movies. They may be hollow, they may be in truly terrible taste, but none of them is going to be about nothing. No ethnic joke or horror movie is ever going to be able entirely to avoid moods of prejudice and nightmare. Or take a really extreme case, the popular song where you're not listening to the words. If you did listen, the words would be about unanswered telephones and bike crashes or being driven, as a Madonna song says, over the borderline. But you're not listening to the words. No, you're not, but you're not looking at the stuff in the back of your mind either. What we're not attending to can have a lot of effect on how we behave. I don't claim that this is easy to understand or not mysterious. I don't even claim to understand it. I only claim that this is how it happens. It's time to return to the movies, to narrow the focus a little. Is there something we need to make sense of in the movies as a medium? Do the movies as a medium tell a story over and above the stories, all the stories they deliver? Stanley Cavell thinks they do. He thinks it's a story of absence and release from power. The movies permit us to view the world without being seen ourselves, he says. I quote, "This is not a wish for power over creation, but a wish not to need power, not to have to bear its burden." In Cavell's image, an audience haunts a movie like a ghost haunting a world. We're glad the world is still there without us, but we're also sad that it should get along so well without us. That is what a ghost feels like, I imagine. This picture, I think, is eloquent, and I think it's true. It's true of the movies. I think it's also true of the way we sometimes feel about our lives. I think all of us must have felt at some point that we were ghosts in our own lives. It's how we feel when we're watching The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, when the newspaper man says, "Print the legend." We can't get in there and stop him from printing the legend. We can't put our knowledge of the truth to work. But I don't think this experience is quite as specific to film as Stanley Cavell suggests. I think it happens quite a lot in all kinds of areas. It doesn't make it less interesting. It makes it less specific to film. I have a friend, an American, who teaches history in Cambridge, in England. He teaches European history, and he once said to me, there's a grim sort of inevitability about history. You know, the same things keep happening every time you teach the course. I mean, round about April, it's 1933 again, and the Reichstag burns, and the Nazis come to power. There's no way of stopping this. It's just the same. There ought to be a way of running the movie differently. That I think, is a characteristic feeling in the movie of helplessness. But it's also a characteristic feeling in life, I think. So it won't do I think, as Cavell wanted to do, as the main story of the movies. In fact, I don't think the movies as a medium have a story to tell at all. But I think they have plenty of stories. They have plenty of stories as a medium, that is, apart from the stories they actually transfer. And I'd like to end with the story that I find in the movies as a medium, and a movie that, an experience that seems to me very close to my experience of film. And now I think this argument would not work for video and for television to the extent that images are repeatable in those forms. Because what I'm about to say, I think, applies very much to the experience of movies in a theatre or to a television show if you watch it once. It doesn't apply to things like instant playbacks of a football game or of a video that you watched again and again to get the dialogue right. Because what I'm going to talk about for a second is the notion of things vanishing, of the notion of things moving, of things not being repeatable. I think the notion of instant replay, I think, is I mean, you probably all experienced this, but I mean, it does produce a dizzying philosophical question, it seems to me. I find now the football match, I can't watch for certain events. I don't see them. I'm waiting for the replay. I don't know whether the ball is in or out, or whether it was a foul or not, whether it hit the bar, or what has happened. I'm waiting to be shown in slow motion and with several replays what actually happened. There is, I think, here. I mean, I don't much believe in complaining about our technologies, but there is here, it seems to me, a chance for a real impoverishment.